I got emailed a press release this week. It was entitled, Christian Leaders Sweeping Money Under the Carpet. And it went on to speak about how we ministers sometimes have an unnecessary timidity when it comes to talking about financial needs and the importance of giving. I thought it was a great time for me to receive that press release, right in the middle of a series on cash and the Christian, not guilty for once. Jesus, of course, well, he's certainly not shy and timid about speaking of money and discipleship. It's hard to know if our story tonight had its origins in Jesus' imagination or in the latest edition of the Jerusalem Times. Whether it's a made-up tale or the latest financial scandal, it doesn't much matter, and either way, it tends to leave people with a headache. It's a parable that turns out to be a rather seedy story of someone cooking the books and meeting with Jesus' approval. It's a headache, made worse, if you imagine that all you do with the parable is retell the story. We'll start there, but by the time Jesus has finished, we'll discover that his story is full of the kind of challenge and encouragement that turns our financial world upside down without a hint or suggestion of any creative accounting. Let's begin with the story, what I've called the manager's scam. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. Verse 1, Jesus told his disciples, there was a rich man whose manager, he seems to have been the one who ran the estate. I guess the equivalent today would be the bank manager, whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. Oh, just a moment, a banker wasting someone's possessions. It could be contemporary, couldn't it? More likely, this was carelessness rather than fraud, but the owner is no fool, and the manager must go. Look at verse 2. So he called him in, and he asked him, what is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be manager any longer. The master wants a full set of accounts, so he knows where he stands, and presumably so that the new manager knows what he's taking on. And verse 3, the manager said to himself, what shall I do now? I mean, here's his problem. And look closely, because it's vital to the point that Jesus is going to make. My master is taking away my job. For the manager, you see, one life is drawing to a close. It's definite. He's been given notice. He can't go on as manager. And the next life is just around the corner. So he's asking, what can he do to make it more welcome, more palatable? I mean, I'm not strong enough to dig. He can't see himself as a navvy digging up roads. And I'm ashamed to beg. He can't see himself busking in the tune, selling the big issue, sitting on the pavement, blanket over him, empty mug held out for coins. He's too proud to beg. Spare any change, Gov, is not for him. Verse 4. See, I know what I'll do. So that when I lose my job here, people welcome me into their homes. I've got it. And a very simple plan it is too. You see what it is? Verse 5. So he called in each one of his master's debtors. He asked the first, how much do you owe my master? 800 gallons of olive oil, he replied. The manager told him, take your bill, sit down quickly and make it 400. Then he asked the second, and how much do you owe? 1,000 bushels of wheat, he replied. He told him, take your bill and make it 800. See, he called in the debtors one by one and drastically reduced their debts. How George Osborne, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, must wish he could find someone who'd do that to Britain's sovereign debt. He reduces them by more than enough to guarantee a warm welcome later. By the way, you understand, don't you, why redundancy can be so brutally swift in some companies today? You know, don't go near your desk unaccompanied. Don't touch your computer. Don't give them any opportunity to pull this scam. But here's the shock, verse 8. The master commended the dishonest manager. Well, I guess at one level, what else could he do? I mean, he'd been outsmarted. The paperwork's all in order. The accounts are drawn up as ordered. I mean, his investment portfolio may have been drastically reduced, but it's no good complaining. I mean, the manager may be a rogue, but he's a clever one. It's a scam, all right, but a smart one. Now, what makes it worse is the master, Jesus, he seems to commend him too. And that's where the headache comes in. I mean, what is the lesson we're supposed to learn from this piece of shady dealing? What moral can this crook possibly teach us? But you see, with parables, it's not enough just to retell the story. Exciting, gripping though some of them are, we need to discover the point that Jesus is making. And look what his boss admires. Not the manager's scam, the manager's shrewdness. See, read to the end of verse 8. The master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. It's not his dishonesty that's commended. The story isn't licensed to cheat or swindle. It's not his methods we're to copy, but his shrewdness. He had acted shrewdly. Now, people who find this parable confusing are almost always not taking this line seriously. Or someone says, yes, but why does Jesus use this story to make his point? Maybe because it was all the news at the time, or maybe, turn back a page with me, will you? Just come to the beginning of chapter 15. You see how Luke begins chapter 15? Now, the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering round to hear Jesus, but the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." See, the Pharisees, the religious types, they're puzzled. The tax collectors and the sinners, the no-goods. I mean, how do they ever belong in God's family? Then verse 3, Jesus told the Pharisees this parable. Well, if you know the chapter, he actually tells them three stories about a lost sheep and a lost coin and a lost son. The prodigal who wastes his fortune, repents, and is welcomed home by his father. Now, turn back over the page again to chapter 16. He's just finished telling those stories, and you see how our chapter begins. Jesus told his disciples this story. Disciples well populated by tax collectors and sinners with a history of cooking the books and rigging the accounts behind them. And he tells the story to make the point that disciples were not to be wasters or crooks, but shrewd. Jesus takes a bad man. There's never any hiding what this man's like, is it, this manager? He's a waster in verse 1. In verse 8, he's a dishonest and unrighteous manager. Jesus takes a bad man and points out one good quality. Bad people do have them. His shrewdness. His foresight. His wisdom in knowing what to do now in the light of what he knew was coming next. And the world can be better at that than we naive Christians sometimes are. You see how verse 8 goes on? For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. Well, the story bears it out, doesn't it? The dishonest manager knows how the world ticks. He's got the emotional intelligence to know how to connect with people. He knows what he needs to do if he's going to get any kind of future for himself. And Jesus wishes we disciples would show the same shrewdness, the same rigorous foresight and understanding in our situations. They're not so different. I'm not accusing you of any shady dealing, but just look. For the manager, the job was over. He's facing dismissal. So he does what he can now to prepare for then. For the disciple, there are many parallels. See, for us, this life is coming to an end. Nothing to do with football matches. It's coming to an end. We're all serving our notice. Some of us, it's longer than others, but we're all serving our notice. And Jesus longs for us to do what we can with what we've got now, to prepare for then, what's ahead. That's what he spells out in verse 9. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. What we've got now is worldly wealth, literally unrighteous mammon. But it can be used for gospel purposes, not buying our way into heaven. No one can do that. But it's heaven determining what we buy. Let me try and illustrate for you. I mean, evangelism ought to be free of charge to those who hear the gospel. But someone has to pay to put the missionaries in the field, whether it's gospelers here in W1 or far away in Central Asia, China, Malaysia, wherever. That's how it worked in New Testament times. Read the letter to the Philippians. It's how it works today. I think of one missionary family I came across. Parents had been missionaries. Two sons followed them to the same mission field. The third son, he stayed at home as an accountant. The bright-eyed, eager, beaver young minister fronted him up to the challenge one day and said to the accountant, why aren't you a missionary? The accountant looked at him patiently and then he said, someone's got to earn the money to keep the rest of the family in the field. See, he's shrewd. He's shrewd. People are led to Christ by that missionary family. They're saved. When it comes to heaven, don't you think the converts will be thrilled to see their missionaries again? But they'll give an equally warm welcome to the accountant. They'll be coming up to him and saying, thank you so much. And he'll look at them and say, what for? Who are you? We've never met, have we? And they'll be saying to him, thank you. It was your money that got us the gospel. It's exciting, the surprises that will be in store for us, if we're shrewd. We had an auction on Friday night to help send our wet foot teams, their sort of short-term cross-cultural teams who go away for a few weeks in the summer, to help send them away to India and Central Asia this summer. I could only slip in for the first few minutes of it, so I thought the best thing I could do was to bake a cake. So I made a cake for the cake auction. One table kind of rallied round, pooled their resources, and managed to buy the cake for a knockdown price of £160. The whole evening raised something like £4,000. I'm afraid the table isn't here tonight. Sorry, they couldn't get here. Someone muttered something about food poisoning to me on the way in, But look, Wet Foot members will be funded to go to Central Asia and India. I mean, can you imagine it in heaven? When the agonies of food poisoning are not even a distant memory, and someone comes up and says, thank you. Thank you. Your generous folly in buying that cake got me the gospel. Then suddenly, that'll be £160 well spent. £4,000 worth giving. The master commended the dishonest manager because he'd acted shrewdly. And did you notice how intentional it was? Look back to verse 3 again, will you? See, the manager said to himself, he sat down and planned it. That's where we're often so different, isn't it? We can be so lazy about it. It's not that we don't want to be generous. It's just that we always land up giving whatever we've got with us at the time. It means a generous heart can find nothing in the wallet or the purse isn't even with them to express itself with. Or you can just find 20p in the pocket and it looks plain embarrassing to put 20p in the basket when it comes round. It's not that we don't mean to be generous. It's just that we can be so bumbling about it, so unbusinesslike. I wonder if some of us take half as much care about our giving as we do about our savings. Look, think of it this way. We have the privilege of many, many visitors coming to us Sunday by Sunday at All Souls, but we actually have 1,500 people who have signed up as committed partners to All Souls for 2010. We have 437 people who are giving by standing orders. Now, I know there are many other ways of planned giving than standing orders. None of these statistics ever really tell the whole story, but 1,500 partners, 437 standing orders, it's at least worth asking the question, are we as intentionally shrewd as this manager? Certainly his shrewdness, if he'd been a British taxpayer, would have used gift aid. I mean, he was wise enough not to pass up the opportunity to add 28% to his giving at no extra expense to himself. And that's the kind of opportunity we'd all spot in our Monday to Friday world. Jesus commended the manager's shrewdness, his foresight, his wise, intentional astuteness, his making the most of what he'd got while he'd still got it. Would he commend yours? Or does he look at us and just see us as bumblingly ineffectual? Do we realize that this shrewdness is even on the list of things he looks for in a disciple? The manager's scam. Yeah, we think of that as soon as we come to this story. But it's the manager's shrewdness that Jesus points to. And I'll be honest, I'd leave it there. Well, I might mention the church giving leaflets as well, worth picking up if you want to be more intentional. Or this little booklet of John Stott's, The Grace of Giving, 10 Principles of Christian Giving, you can get for £1 at the Resource Centre. But, you know, I'd basically leave it there. Point made, job done. So please don't blame me for going on. Jesus doesn't leave it there. Some skulls are very hard to penetrate, aren't they? Even some religious skulls can be very hard to penetrate. Did you notice when you get to verse 14, he speaks about Pharisees who loved money. And they are totally unmoved by this story and the lesson he's drawing. So let me make another point. Another point that Jesus makes. What I've called the money lover's snares. It's Jesus relentlessly ramming his point home, making sure I realize it's not enough just to nod in agreement at what he's saying. And it's fatal to switch off and ignore him. See, here's the first thing he tells me. There's an investment I must make. Look at verse 10. Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. And whoever's dishonest with very little can also be dishonest with very much. Striking, isn't it? Jesus speaks of our worldly wealth in the here and now as very little. Maybe accurate for one or two of us, but this is for anyone. You know, your bank account, your investments, your real estate, your influence, your position, your friends, your talents, your gifts, they're very little compared with what his future world holds in store for us disciples. But little things matter. That's what verse 11 tells me. You see what it says? So, if you've not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? If you can't handle very little, why should God trust you with very much? Now, as I was looking at this, I thought, Jesus isn't really very British here, is he? He doesn't have that attitude that religion and money shouldn't mix. He doesn't fall into the super spiritual trap of imagining that true faith has nothing to do with sordid finances. No, true faith is expressed through our checkbooks. And verse 12, if you've not been trustworthy with someone else's property. I mean, that's how he views all our things. Someone else's property. God's. On loan to us as stewards for no longer than a lifetime. Yeah, that's the sort of line I can agree to in church on Sunday, isn't it? It just feels very different when I'm actually handling the money the rest of the week. It's my money. I earned it. I'll decide how I spend it. Well, of course you will. But if I think like that, I'll always miss the point. Verse 12, if you've not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? Glory itself. Not on loan. No, truly. Totally, eternally ours. Please notice, this isn't Jesus putting my arm up my back, forcing open my wallet, extracting everything from it. This is just the clear, obvious logic that giving is not losing, but investing. Try talking to yourself like that. Then ask, what can I afford to do without? Ask, how much do I want to invest in my future? How much do I want to invest? An investment I must make. Or again, a choice I must decide. Look at verse 13. No servant can serve two masters. Either he'll hate the one and love the other, or he'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and mammon. Now, you don't really believe it, of course. And I don't live as if it's true. I realize the dangers. I understand you have to be careful. I quite see it's difficult to serve both God and mammon. No, Jesus says, I can't. Not you shouldn't, not you mustn't, not it's very hard to, not it would be better not to. You can't serve God and mammon. In other words, you are serving one or the other. Which one is it? Remember that line of Rick Warren, the American pastor I mentioned two or three weeks back? Every time I give, I break the chains of materialism. Put it in the context of this line. You can't serve God or mammon. Every time I give, I'm saying, money is not my master, Jesus is Lord. Money is not my master, Jesus is Lord. It's a choice. I need to decide and keep on deciding. I need to keep on making clear who my master is. Money is not my master, Jesus is Lord. One family, after we looked at last week's passage, where Jesus taught, if you remember, about the giving of capital, not just our income. One family have decided this. They're doing this. They're going through every room in the house, finding at least something from every room in the house that they're going to sell. Either put it on eBay and give away the proceeds, or give to one of the charity shops. The children are joining in as well. See, as they go around each room, they're saying, money's not my master. Things are not my master. Jesus is Lord. An investment I must make. A choice I must decide. A sneer I must avoid. Look at verse 14. The Pharisees who loved money, yeah, those Pharisees, heard all this and were sneering at Jesus. It's all over the top for them. The Jesus they often accuse of being too lax is now too strict. This from Pharisees who scrupulously give a tenth of all that I get. I don't know exactly what they're sneering at, the crudeness with which Jesus speaks, the dodginess of his dishonest manager, the silence about their wealth being a sign of God's blessing, which is how they and others saw it. Take it all with a pinch of salt, they're sneering. And Jesus said to them, verse 15, you are the ones who justify yourselves in the eyes of men, but God knows your hearts. What is highly valued among men is detestable in God's sight. I don't know how well you know this chapter, but by the end of it, Jesus goes on to tell another parable, the story of the rich man who has it all, and Lazarus, the poor beggar, at his gate every day. And the rich man gives Lazarus neither a second thought nor a first penny. And when they die, Lazarus is in heaven, and the money-loving rich man is in hell, in torment, detestable in God's sight. Luke, you'll discover if you study his gospel closely, often strings a series of stories or parables together to make a point, and he's doing it here. You see, the prodigal and its explanation of the grace that means the wasteful spender on himself can still find a place at home with the Father. And that's followed by the dishonest manager and its encouragement to be a shrewd investor, to use the things while you have them now to invest in the eternal world to come. And then the rich man and Lazarus and its warning. You cannot serve both God and money. Well, says someone, is this all for gift day? And the answer is, of course it is. I mean, what rector would put on a series about cash and the Christian and not coincide it with gift day? Even I'm not that thick. Ah, you say, so this is all about gift day. Of course it's not. It's about something far more serious than a mere gift day. God knows your hearts. Sees our bank accounts. What does he find? A shrewd investor or a money-loving fool?